Loaded episode of the Kevin O'Connor Show coming up with a whole bunch of topics about things going on around the NBA. Welcome back to the Kevin O'Connor Show. We got some news. Shams Charania said Jimmy Butler has been suspended indefinitely after he walked out of shoot-around on Monday morning when he was informed, you're not starting. Haywood Highsmith was going to be starting moving forward, and now Butler might be sidelined indefinitely moving forward. Who knows? We might have seen Butler play his final game with the Miami Heat. And I'll tell you what, before we get to my guest, Danny Green answering your mailbag questions and Dane Moore talking Minnesota Timberwolves, I just got to say this about Jimmy Butler. This is the right decision for the Heat. Get rid of him as soon as possible. You got some good things going in Miami. Tyler Hero elevating his play to a whole new level this year, transforming the way he plays. Khalil Ware looking like the potential rookie of the year this month. 20-plus points, three games in a row, looking like an 80-light, two-way dominant force. There's good things happening in Miami. You can't let Jimmy Butler, the malcontent, ruin all of that. Like I ranted about last week, Butler pushed his way out of Minnesota, and Philly, he stopped shooting threes because he didn't like the way the offense worked. And now in Miami, after years of success, what's he doing? Pushing his way out, tarnishing his legacy. This guy had never cared about the Heat organization. He just wanted to live in sunny Florida. And now all he wants is his long-term extension at 35 years old. And doesn't even care about winning a championship, going to the team that offers him the best chance to win. The Heat are making the right decision, suspending him because he shouldn't be part of this team when there's good things happening there. The team that gets him, it's probably not going to end well. Too bad for them. Whoever ends up with him, I don't think it's going to be a very good decision. All right, let's bring on Danny Green to answer your mailbag questions. We got so many of them, we weren't able to get to all of them. And just a quick heads up, 1 week from today, we're going to be doing a full trade deadline edition mailbag. So send in your favorite trade ideas, thoughts, comments, questions, whatever you want to kocshow@yahoosports.com. Or if you're watching on YouTube or listening on Spotify, just respond. Hit me up in the comment section and we'll take the best ones and include it in next week's episode. Today I'm answering your mailbag questions with Danny Green, three-time NBA champion. So let's get straight to it. Let's get on to the first question from Dave. Dave asks, what's Amen Thompson's ceiling as a player? And so just to give some context to this question, Danny, this month, Amen Thompson is averaging 18 points per game, 12 boards, four assists, two steals, one block, playing elite defense. He had two absolute monster games over this past week and wins the Rockets had over the Cavaliers. To me, he looks like a top 50, 60 player right now, today.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, like, what do you think about his actual ceiling is as a player, though?
I think he's very good, has a lot of potential, a lot of pieces, and he's showing it. And I think I like the way the Rockets are playing because it's not just one guy doing it, right? They're doing it collectively. They have a lot of guys that are great, which kind of sucks because they don't have anybody that's going to make the All-Star team because and they're in the top-seeded team in the West because there's no one guy that's, like, showing out. None of them get All-Star.
Şengün could make All-Star.
He could, but the numbers issue, I don't know. You know, especially with the centers, you talk about Jokic and those guys in AD, like it's hard. I think when I look at Amen Thompson, I'm thinking like for some reason Andre Iguodala comes to mind. You know what I'm saying? So like I could see that being like his ceiling. You know, he could be that type of player. You know, Iggy came in very athletic, long arms, wings, defender, became All-Star at one point in Philly and, you know, became a it's crazy to call him a role player because he decided to go to from Denver to Golden State become a role player, but you know NBA Finals MVP at one point. So I could see Amen Thompson being very similar to that style of a player.
Yeah, and he was a 2-time All Defensive Player. I think Amen Thompson, like if Iguodala entered the league when Amen Thompson did, I think Iguodala could have had an even greater career just with the way the game is different. Yeah, the game is, right?
It's very much more open. it's faster pace. It's not
in part because of him on those Warriors team, right?
Because him and them pretty much shifted the league to the small ball, you know, era and making guys play perimeter, all you know, five out type of thing. So, with the game today, I think Iggy, his numbers would be a little bit different than when they were when the game was a lot slower in half court, you know, set more often.
And that's the thing with Amen Thompson. It's like the Rockets offensively, they use him as a screener, on ball, off ball. He's in the dunker spot.
He's athletic enough to play all five positions. He's quick enough. He could jump. He could play the four or five. He said he could be a roll lob threat guy. Like, he's just athletic as hell. And they're doing some good things with him.
You mentioned how he's athletic as hell. There was some stat that Synergy's Todd Whitehead posted on X recently where it was jumps clearing 24 inches. So these were the biggest leapers in the NBA. And the top five was Jalen Green, number one, Anthony Edwards, number two, Missy, the New Orleans center, number three, Amen Thompson, fourth, with 326 jumps clearing 24 inches. Wow. I'd be curious to see the stat from Todd Whitehead, if he can look this up. Who are the quickest leapers? Who are the guys that get to the peak of their jumps the quickest, especially on block attempts? Because, like, yeah. Amen Thompson has some blocks this year where it's just like he's on the ground and then he's suddenly at the hoop, hand on the ball. Like, he's like a rocket ship when he's leaping for a block shot.
No, his reflexes, like, he's very much cat-like, you know, he's a, let's say, lion. He's very much like, said
poking at the ball for steals too. It's like not just blocks, but steals too.
But I'm shocked that I didn't hear Kuminga's name in there, because Kuminga is athletic as hell too. But I guess he's just not jumping as much. When he does jump, he's very explosive. But Zion's another one. Quick second bounce. Like, he jumps gets a second bounce quick. There's not many guys that were good at that. You know, had quick jumps or get to the rim fast. You know, you look at the back in the days, like, Dwayne Wade, for his height, being able to be explosive as he was, get to the rim, is explosive. Charles Barkley, like, they are 6'4 guys that were getting to the rim and dunking people. You just don't see that often. He's a special player, a special athlete.
So the Rockets played the Celtics on Monday night. The Celtics have been barely over 500 since early December. Regardless of like, your level of panic or not panic for Boston, I'm curious, like, if the Celtics are missing one thing, what's the thing that you think they're missing the most?
I just, you know, we talked about it on the show. We talked on different platforms for me. And I'm not too worried about it, but I just think it's a kind of a summer hangover for some of those guys. You know, they are played all summer Olympics. They have four of the guys in Olympics, having a long season. I think they just need to get to All-Star break and get a fresh start, like a refresh, a reset button type thing. But to me, I think they're the best team in the league, except for when they're not healthy. They just came back with injuries. Jrue Holiday got back. Porzingis, he's the main guy that I worry about. If you don't have him, you're in trouble, especially when you play teams like Cleveland, teams like Knicks, the New York Knicks, or OKC coming out the West. And if they're healthy, I think Boston is going to be tough to repeat if they're not 100%. Like, with him or Horford. Horford's a little older now, but they need both those bigs to be playing and playing well in their system. Because they're going to need them, and because they're dual threats. They can go inside, they can rebound, they can protect the rim, and they can shoot threes for them.
So we got a question on X from JD13, and JD asks, what's the one trade you think the Celtics should do to ensure a repeat as NBA champions? And I think, Danny, you nailed it. It's support, like, behind Porzingis, because if he's out, they're not going to win it. So to me, I think it's about finding another big, like, look, they have, like,
they could try to get Robin Williams. They could try to get him back.
That'd be tough salary wise though, as a second apron team. So it's like, they're so limited in their options there. Like, Cornette's solid and Cade's solid, but they need somebody better than that. And so I've heard that they're, you know, open to trading Jaden Springer. He's been playing lately. I'd imagine that they're trying to feature him.
Yeah, Jaden's very good. Value.
He's a very good defender. He's, you know, hitting some threes for Boston, some clutch threes. But I'd look to flip Jaden Springer for a big. I think De'Ron Sharp from the Nets would be interesting. If they package two firsts with Springer to the Jazz for Walker Kessler, I'd be interested in that type of trade package as well.
I think teams that are going to give up their big, they're going to want more in return than just Jaden. I love Baby J. He just needs to find
two firsts. What about with two firsts?
Two firsts would help. It definitely helps. But trying to get Walker Kessler, I feel like Utah really values him.
They do. I don't think they don't need to trade him. But
and who was maybe the other big?
De'Ron Sharp from the Nets.
De'Ron, I like De'Ron a lot. It's just since I think he had a hamstring issue, right? He's kind of hasn't showed the same explosiveness I think most people are kind of leery of. But his rebounding skills have been unbelievable. The way he can offensive rebound, too. Yeah. underrated big, man. He can do a little bit. He can shoot like the mid-range pretty decently, too. From, you can stretch it some. You know, he can stretch it some. Just got to be more consistent with it. But, yes, he is a really good piece that most teams should be looking at to try to get if you want to get, like, a good, solid backup big.
Well, the Celtics can trade up to 3 firsts. They also have 3 swaps, 6 seconds. Brad Stevens has made a move every single deadline. He's been GM. Derek White and Daniel Tice in 2022, got Muscala in 2023, and then Xavier Tillman in 2024. So we'll see what the Celtics do. I'd make a move, whether it's for a big or like a big wing, like a Torrey Craig type of guy. I think something like that could make sense for them. And, you know, I think for Boston, you know, Cleveland's playing 500 basketball lately.
They're only a handful of games.
A lot of injuries. Only a handful of games back. I mean, going to get the one seed and have assuring home court throughout the postseason would be a big benefit for a team like home court like Boston, I'd say.
Yeah, I don't know if they'll get that. Cleveland's been playing. I think it was Caris LeVert that was out. Dean Wade just got hurt in the game. Evan Mobley was out. I feel like somebody else was out. They're just low on bodies right now, and they need a reset. So they lost 2 in a row, first time in a while. But I could see them getting back on track and doing what they're supposed to do. They're up a good amount of games. They have the space. I could see them take care of business regular season. Cleveland's regular season is not the issue. It's seeing, you know, how well they do in the postseason. So, yeah. But Boston, yeah, a little bit more depth, like you said, in that big man area would help them a lot.
A reminder to listeners, if you're watching or listening on YouTube and Spotify, leave a comment with a trade question for next Monday's episode or hit me up over email at kocshow@yahoosports.com because next Monday we're going to be doing all trade stuff since it's trade deadline week. Danny, we got a question from Josh. Would love to hear your thoughts about one of the hottest teams in basketball, the Indiana Pacers, particularly their defensive turnaround. They're 10-5 since the NBA Cup began. They had a long week-long break, 5th in offensive rating, 6th in defensive rating since then. What's been behind this Pacers turnaround this past month and a half, Danny?
They look like they're playing with a better pace, a little more upbeat, but I'm still not a big believer just yet because strength of schedule is a thing. I can't recall correctly, but I don't know how many teams were in the 15 games that were like above 500 teams or the top like contenders or playoff teams. But they're playing pretty good basketball. They're just so up and down to me. You just never know. You know, they're very much a hot and cold type of group. Right now they're hot with Tyrese Halliburton being aggressive and playing pretty strongly. But
dude, Halliburton's been so much better, man. Like that break must have helped him.
Probably helped him a lot. But you just know how – I mean, that's the life of any player, right? This wave, especially the shooters, up and downs and lows. But as a superstar, I think a lot of people would like to see him be more aggressive, like consistently aggressive and be that guy more so than not. But – they go as far as aggressive as he is, you know, and, you know, him as of late or last year or so has been kind of up and down.
I mean, with Halliburton, ever since the week of the NBA Cup, he's been shooting the hell out of the ball, 40.7%. Since then, prior to that, he was at 33.6%. And one of the differences I've noticed with him, and I'm glad this has happened, I've been calling this for years, we're seeing more mid-range from him. He was taking only 13% of his shots from mid-range prior to the NBA Cup. That's up to 18%. And maybe that's just small sample size, but he's always been an elite mid-range shooter. Like, to me, I think it just adds more variety to his offense. But with their defense, Nembhard coming back.
Now, would you consider a floater mid-range?
I think you can consider it a floater.
He's a great floater guy. I didn't see him shoot it as much. I think he deferred more. When Pascal got there and other guys, Mathurin, got back healthy, like they're a fully healthy team, I feel like he was just passive and deferred some. But, yes, him attacking the rim, getting to that floater, you know, mixing it up, I think gives him and them a very much more, you know, some more weapons and like makes him more dynamic.
And back to Josh's question, I mean, I think Nembhard coming back has been big for their defense. He's a stopper on ball, super aggressive. Feels like they've been a bit more aggressive in help situations, and Miles Turner doing great, cleaning things up. I'd like to bring on at some point Caitlin Cooper, the great Pacers writer, to talk about Indiana later in the month. Next question from Juan. How much of a difference are their Suns with Nick Richards?
I wouldn't say huge difference, but it was a good pickup. It was a really good pickup for them. And it seemed like a small move because most people don't know Nick about his game. And in Charlotte, he had some like phases where he just kind of was, not say out there, but they didn't show much. So people couldn't, it was hard to evaluate him. But put him in the right system with the right players and the right pieces, he can be very valuable. And he's a great lob threat, you know, big man that can protect the rim and rebound and do a little bit of everything. So Phoenix had really needed, you know, some solid centers. And that's first of a point guard was the issue, then it was centers. Nurkic couldn't do it all by himself. They had Plumlee. They're both solid bigs, but I think they just needed some more depth there. So he's a really big pickup, good pickup for them.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny with Nick Richards. Like, he had his big first game, 21 points, double-double, and then he had four rebounds in a game against the Cavaliers. And after the great performance he had against the Wizards, you know, 20 points, 19 rebounds, he almost had 20 and 20. You know, I think it was him or one of his teammates said, like, they reminded him why we got you. And that after that Cavs game where he wasn't rebounding the ball. And so he comes out, he's been rebounding since then, 15 against the Nets, 19 against the Wizards. But, like, I mentioned good performances against the Pistons, good performances against the Nets and Wizards. Like, he's got to be better against the Cavaliers of the world for any of this to mean anything for Phoenix. And that's where, like, I have concerns with them overall. Like, yes, Nick Richards helps. He's in a big upgrade over Yusuf Nurkic. like you, they have, like, the hardest schedule remaining in the NBA.
So the we're going to see. It's going to be a schedule. Test. We're going, like, to see what he does. This is it. Like, I mean, obviously against those other teams, he looks great. But we got to see what he does against the top team. So,
yes,
I think him getting a rhythm, getting a feel for it, only builds his confidence. Because I don't think he had a big amount of confidence being in Charlotte. Being with these guys and playing well with those guys, it helps a ton.
Did you see the Yusuf Nurkic quote after or during one of the games the other day? Did you see this?
He said something recently.
So Nurkic said to Dwayne Rankin, a writer covering the Suns and Phoenix, he said basically him and Mike Budenholzer have no relationship. He said, you know, they haven't talked for months. He says, we don't have a relationship, so it's fine. For me, just be a pro and do the best I can. Work and stay ready for whatever might be. But there's no chaos or bringing that to this team. They already have plenty of it. Trying to be as professional as I can and work my ass off for something else. He's on the Suns, referring to his team as they. Yeah. The other side of this question from Juan, he says, you know, if Nurkic is in the starting center, he seems like a serviceable number two. Do you think that relationship is too far gone? I've never been on an NBA roster. I'd say, yes, it's too far gone. What do you think as a guy that spent over a decade playing on a bunch of different teams, different situations in the NBA? Is it too far gone for Nurkic? Because he said a hell of a lot more than that too.
I'm sure that I'm sure that interview had led to a conversation, and the only way you can pull back is if the conversation went well, where there was some understanding. Obviously, most pros, most vets, the issue is the lack of communication. And if we're not getting any, and you're just sitting us and not telling us what's going on, we're not playing at all, then it's like we feel disrespected. We don't mind not playing, but tell us why. Tell us what's going on. Tell us what you're looking to do. Are you looking to trade us? Are you looking to do this? Is this guy playing well? Cool. But, or at least let me get an opportunity to show that I could still be a solid number two. But if you're not giving me the opportunity to do anything, especially when they're not practicing as much anymore, I should be figuring out where I should take my talents elsewhere. You know, like, all right, if that's the case, you guys don't need me here, I'll find somewhere else to go. And we can do that professionally. But if I can't get a conversation out of you, I have to tell the media this in order for you to speak to me. This is pretty bad. You know, that's a bad scenario to be in.
Did you have any overlap with Budenholzer in San Antonio?
Yes. He was my first couple of years. I was filming with Bud all the time. He's great. And
is he the type of coach that would talk to his players about why you're not playing?
He was an assistant then, so he talked to us more than he said. I've never had him at a head coach. So he definitely talked to us. He brought me, Kawhi, Corey Joseph, all the young guys in the film room. We go over stuff before we went to film. So I don't know. Said I couldn't give you his head coaching vibes, but he seems like a guy that would, you know, be straight up with you and talk. But I don't know. You know, I only know him as an assistant.
Does that always need to be communicated when you're Yusuf Nurkic and you can't finish around the rim and you can't stop anything at the basket on defense? Like, isn't the answer obvious why you're not playing and why you're getting benched?
Think, but at the same time, like I said, you're a vet, you're a pro, you've been here for some years. A conversation could happen. Conversations could happen at any point, all the time. It's like, all right, well, listen, we have this guy. He's been playing really well, so that's why you'll get an opportunity. Somebody this and that. If not, like, we'll look for a place for you to go somewhere else. You know, that's simple.
Well, they're looking. They're looking hard.
I'm sure. I'm sure they could use some pieces for him, and he would like to be somewhere else as well. But yeah, it just doesn't go over. I've been in situations where there was great communication, which I loved, and there was none. And it's like, and I don't think that. Actually, I do. I hold it against the coaches that didn't communicate. I don't look at him as a terrible coach, but I just don't think you as a great coach. If you can't communicate to your vets or your players, what's going on without some, you know, I said some common sense to it. His seems more common sense to it, but other situations, it's like there's no rhyme or reason to some how things were happening. It was just, you know, on the go. So we're like every day, everybody's trying to figure out who's going to play, who's doing what. It's like that's not a good way to operate. But yes, I think he knows. I think he's looking for an opportunity to redeem himself, which they're not giving him that at all. But you know, if not, he said you need to be looking elsewhere.
Last question here from Travis. I'm going to change this question a little bit. He asked, if you're a Warriors fan, wouldn't you want your star, Stephen Curry, to express their disappointment and put pressure on the front office to improve the team? Isn't this bad leadership? I'm going to change that for you. No? Not as a fan. What about as a player in the locker room?
Say that again. As a fan?
As a fan, shouldn't you have some disappointment in Steph not pressuring the front office to make improvements? What about as a player in the locker room? No?
No.
Still no?
First of all, I mean, fans, you can be disappointed all you want, but that's not Steph's job. Steph's job is to go out and play. It ain't my job to tell front office what to do, and especially not do it publicly. Now,
publicly, privately.
Maybe he is. We don't know that. Mm-hmm. We don't know what these conversations having privately. But as a fan, you can't have it both ways. You hate when the player speaks out against the front office. You know what I'm saying? Like
the LeBron tactic.
They hate when they don't speak. They hate when they do speak. It's like, all right, yeah. So if the guy's constantly in the media talking about the front office, and it's like, oh, you guys, you know, he's on the organization. He shouldn't be doing that. When he doesn't say anything, it's like, oh, he's not speaking up for himself. He needs to be telling the front office. What can these guys do to win? They can't win. But Steph handles himself very much in the right way.
The funny thing is that like this month it was both ways with Steph. He had the quote in the ESPN story where he talked about the two timelines. You know, we look back at the retrospect on it will probably not be great. And then he had the quote where it was the opposite, where it was like, well, we're not going to rush things and make trades that we shouldn't make. And like both times, there's this crazy reaction to it, regardless of what path you take as a player. That's true. That's fair.
Anything you say, they're going to dissect it and give you some criticism. So. To me, Steph has always been the ultimate professional and handled things the right way. Giannis, the same. Like, they go, they talk to the media. He's very humble. He describes himself, and he does his job. He shows up to work, and he believes in his team, encourages his team, and gives his teammates a lot of credit for allowing him to be great. So I have no problems with how Steph handles things. I have no problems with how most superstars handle things. But, yeah, there's a couple guys in that boat that are like, all right, you know, they're respectable. They don't go out and bash their front office and say, we need to do this or do that, or try to put pressure on them.
Do you have any hope for the Warriors right now? They're just on the play-in bubble at the moment.
I mean, I think they could be in the play-in games. Hope to do what? To win a championship? that's not a real conversation.
Okay. All right.
I mean, I have hope for them to be in the play-in and possibly making the playoffs. It's always great to see that those guys, like, nobody wants a playoff series without KD, Bron, and Steph. You want all those guys in the playoffs at some point. So I have hope that they can make the playoffs and be in the play-in.
I mean, they're currently on the outside looking in of the play-in, as crazy as that is. Like, but Kings, how close Mavs, the games Suns, are, well, of
it's
course.
It's decided within 4 or 5 games. You know, you go on a 5-game leader, next you know you're in 8.
Yeah, the Lakers right now are in 5th. The Warriors in currently 11th place are only it's 4 crazy, games back.
The Lakers were outside. They won, before they won the last 2 or 3 games, Lakers were what, like 10? 9, yeah, 10.
It's just all so condensed right now in the West. It's a crazy thing about it. It's going to be a fun final stretch, a fun few weeks ahead of the deadline as well. I have a trivia question for you, Danny.
Shoot.
You were traded five times in your NBA career. Who was traded the most in their NBA career?
So, I don't know why Luke Ridnour came to my mind.
Not Luke Ridnour.
But it's not Luke Ridnour. It's somebody that played probably 4 or 5. Ish Smith played for a lot of different teams. It's probably somebody that's known, huh? Is it a bigger name person or is it like a?
It's a role player.
Okay,
I'll give it to you. Trevor Ariza traded 11 times in his career. That's crazy. Wow.
Yeah, that's a lot. I didn't even know I traded. What you said? 5 times? You said or 6?
5 times. Yeah, 5 times.
I didn't know that. I know it was. A trade to Toronto, a trade to OKC, then to Philly. So I guess that's a double trade, but it's all in one summer. And then from Philly to Memphis, and then Memphis to Houston. Yeah, and then I was bought out and then picked up by Cleveland.
Crazy. Yeah, so, and you were traded at the deadline 2 years ago. Is that kind of a, like, mid-season trades are dramatically different, I'm sure, than off-season trades,
right? Yeah, that was my first time being traded mid-season.
Tough?
Yes. pick up and leave. You know what I'm saying? It's off-season, you have time to, like, find a place to live, get settled, situated, be with a group. Joining a group halfway through the season is very different. And then picking up your family and leaving and trying to find a place to live, or just being in a hotel and figuring out the rest of the season, it's not easy.
I mean, the off-court stuff is tough enough, but, like, one of the things that a couple front office people have always said to me is, like, the risk in trading for a player during the season is getting them integrated into the system. Like, there's just no practice time. It's tough to get somebody up
to get the rhythm.
Everything. Rhythm.
You're trading for basically for the following year. It's like, all right, we're making these guys trades. Unless you're a contender, it's like, all right, this guy has to – most of those trades, I feel like, for the following year, for guys to get acclimated and, or maybe just get off contracts. But it's very hard to make something happen midseason during that time.
Deals are hard enough to make, you know, for all the reasons you're talking about, family and, you know, integrating a guy. And now you have the CBA on top of that. I look forward to seeing what the deadline's going to be like. Danny,
aren't we all?
Appreciate you joining today, man.
Anytime, man. I appreciate you having me. Thank you. Same with you, man. Continue with the great, you know, stuff you got going here. And the questions. Thanks to the fans that are, you know, tuning in and shooting us with the good stuff.
Appreciate it, Dan. You can find him at Inside the Green Room over on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, he's all over ESPN as well. Thanks, Danny.
Thank you.
All right, we got a mailbag question from Johnny, who said, please have at Dane Moore NBA back on the show. So here he is, Dane Moore from the Dane Moore NBA podcast. What's up, Dane?
What's up, man? I thought you forgot about the Wolves. I did Adam Mares' show last week, too. And I'm like, yeah, got a lot more requests a season ago, you know. They're kind of good again now. I don't know. Somewhere in the middle. They're all right. They're all right.
Yeah, they're kind of good again, it seems like. I mean, you were on early in the season, and we talked about a whole bunch of stuff. You know, Anthony Edwards at the time, he was just starting to shoot a ton of threes. That's continued. But I don't think we could have seen that Minnesota would be a 500 team into 2025. They were 17-17 entering January 6th. And since then, they're 7th in offensive rating after being 21st in offensive rating, everything not looking good earlier in the year, 111.0 rating to 118.1 rating over these last few weeks. So that's why I wanted to bring you on today, because it feels like something's different with Minnesota. What have you observed from the Wolves to see this improved offense over this month, Dan?
Let's go in reverse order. Let's start with the last game. The Denver game that they played great. I think it was the best game of the season, won by 28 or 29. And what worked offensively in that game, surprisingly to people probably because they think he's trash at offense, was Rudy Gobert was awesome. And specifically, you know, you talk about Ant taking all of those threes. The real adjustment that we've seen almost every single night is every team is putting two on the ball. Rudy comes up and sets a screen for Ant, two on the ball. Nuggets were doing that with Jokic. It's Brown and it's Jokic up there basically just trapping Ant. So you're not getting that three, right? You can't just step into that three. You need to find the rolling big in the middle of the floor. The problem with the Wolves starting five is he doesn't have the most sure hands, or those when he drops it, it's just such an energy suck and it kind of falls apart. But Ant repeatedly and consistently in the first quarter found Rudy Gobert there, and Rudy caught it, found Jaden McDaniels cutting from the corner. He found one time like Jamal Murray rotated over as the low man. All right, got a 6'2 guy on me. I'm just going to turn and dunk and finish. And then even had a couple push shots in that game that he took there. Rudy Gobert operating effectively in the middle of the floor is gigantic for the Wolves offense, because it is the counter to teams taking away Anthony Edwards, which if you're the Wolves, you can't have happen. They did that against Denver. They're going to see that coverage again and again and again, and they need to go to that action again and again and again, because you know what happens? What Denver did, they turn away from it. They stop playing that coverage. They put Jokic in a deep drop. And then you know what happens when Jokic is in a deep drop? All right, Let's set that same screen with Rudy and step into a three, step into a three, step into a three, and you get back to that volume and the Wolves' most effective offense, which is Ant stepping into threes. You need to do something to create that to happen if the defense is taking it away.
I mean, you mentioned Anthony Edwards, how, you know, facing two and Rudy Gobert able to help, you know, off of those roles, creating for others. There's this quote from, you know, Ant over the weekend, how he, you know, he's consulted Michael Jordan. He reached out to him. How do you deal with double teams? It was from Mark Jones over at ESPN. He looked for advice because he's been frustrated with that. He's talked about that openly. He said, you know, a couple of weeks ago, I don't want to be used facing all these double teams. Are you seeing progress from him in that category? It was more just about like how everybody else is performing off of those blitzes and pick and rolls, off of that, the doubles that he's seeing.
The two times, Kevin, that he's blown up to us in the media after the games were Oklahoma City and Boston, you know? And so that's not even just putting two on the ball. That's putting two Boston defenders, putting two OKC defenders on him. And what was funny about that Boston one in particular was like, he did what he did in that Denver game. He got off of it, and like the surrounding players made like 55% of their threes that game. So it was weird. I walk into the locker room. I'm like, what? Like, you just want to score? Like, this worked. You barely lost this this game to Boston. But like, it was because you need to first get off of it, let your guys go, and then take advantage of the defense adjusting off of it. And he never, in that Boston game before he blew up and said that, like, he didn't get to that part of it, but the surrounding pieces were there. So I take this Denver game on Saturday to be a growth and learning from Ant of like X equals Y, you know? And that's the, I mean, it's the interesting thing, right, about covering a 23-year-old kid is you want him to be great and you know he can be, but there's steps in this process that are, you know, that are learning. And it's weird with Ant sometimes, like the playoffs last year, sometimes it feels like he's got it. All right, the playmaking's there. He's, you know, Phoenix is guarding him this way. He's finding the guy in the corner. Denver's guarding him this way. He's finding him, his teammates in other sort of ways. He can't get bored with that. He can't get bored with that because if you go to it enough, they're going to adjust and they're going to let you go. Like, and I think those games, I think the OKC game was end of December and the Boston one was like a couple days later, and he was frustrated, but here we are at the end of the month. And it's like, all right, we got 48 minutes of tape in this Denver game against every coverage. This is how you do it. And he still got his 34. Like, it's the biggest thing is beating those double teams and being patient in how you do.
I mean, to his point, like earlier in the season, guys are not finishing off of those situations. He's getting blitzed more than anybody in the NBA. That's not just, you know, an overall statement. It's factual. You know, he's getting blitzed 16% of the time out of pick and rolls this season. It's the number one mark in the NBA, ahead of like a guy like Stephen Curry, ahead of Kevin Durant, Kyrie Irving, guys like that. So for Ant, now success is coming off of those actions. You mentioned Gobert making better decisions, whether as a scorer or a passer, and you mentioned a play where McDaniels was cutting from the corner. In that situation, McDaniels has also been a hell of a lot better in January. He got off to a really up and down start over the first few months for Minnesota. What's been better with him throughout the month of January besides just better shooting numbers? Is there anything else?
It's not shooting numbers. It's just quicker decisions out of the corner and actually not shooting corner threes. Shooting 28% from the corners this season. And it's literally like the last five games, he's like doing this thing where the ball's coming to him in the corner where a lot of like, you know, a guy that's going to normally hit a corner three at a 40% clip if they're open, like he's not that. So he's catching, he's almost getting his feet started before to catch and go like immediately and making that 0.5 mentality that Finch talks about all the time. He's making these quick decisions to not never take a corner three, but if there's an opportunity that use his 6'11 frame to go and finish at the basket, find a lob to Rudy, keep the ball moving. Like, the biggest thing, Kevin, is he's making quick decisions out of the corner, and he's often making the decision to not shoot the corner three. We've gotten to this point too much, I think, around the NBA with players of Jaden's shooting capability of being like, yeah, man, it's a corner three. It's a good shot. It's not a good shot for everybody. And sometimes it's really tough when the defense is guarding you in a way that is designed to get to a Jaden McDaniels corner three. Like, you can't just oblige and do that four times in a row. And if you miss, like that's another way where the Wolves' energy just kind of drains. And I've loved what Jaden has done and being more active out of the corners, which I think has spread to his game, just overall greater activity. You mentioned the beginning of the season being rough. The first nine games of the season, he had 22 rebounds, total rebounds. The last nine games of the season, he has 65. This movement, this activity, this 0.5 mentality gets Jaden going. And it's, if you want to talk about this team like leveling up and making a run, I don't think many people would talk about point to Jaden in particular, but it needs to be Jaden because he can't be a negative. He can't be a problem from the corner because you already have a non-shooter in Gobert in your starting lineup. And Randall is a, you know, a not super like guarded perimeter shooter. You know, he shoots them, but they need it to be so that it's not both McDaniels and Gobert as spacing issues on this team. And that's what the McDaniels element of it is, has gone away through quick decision makings. And then the Rudy part, at least in that last game, was less, and he beat the Nuggets by 30. Man, it's like they need better offense. This is how you get it.
Is this just a little hot stretch, or do you find that there's something sustainable in here? Because the person who requested you to come on the podcast, Johnny, did also ask a question. He says, "Is there any team in the league that makes sense for Julius Randle? He's been playing better as of late, but we can't have him opt in and lose out on Naz Reid and Nah." So, like, there's still concern from some Wolves fans about the Randle fit, despite the recent success, which has involved him. He's played well in some of these games. Like, I guess that's where I'm coming from with this thought here. Like, is this actually sustainable with what you're seeing? Like, is there still a need to shake up this roster as the deadline approaches?
Well, another improvement in the offense prior to the Gobert stuff and the McDaniels stuff I was just talking about is kind of in the 3-4 weeks prior to that. You go back to like the turn of the, you know, late December, early January, they really found something with the five outlook. Gobert's off the floor, Naz Reid's at the five, and Randall's at the four. And oftentimes Jaden wasn't out there with him. It'd be like DiVincenzo, Alexander Walker, maybe like Mike Conley out there with him. You know, that's five shooters out there. So they found more lineups that Julius can not only be a part of and effective, but almost gets it going. Like, he's the engine of those five out offenses oftentimes, whether Ant is in there or not. He is good at, which it's hard, talk about the Wolves fans being fed up with him, that is an understatement. It's not some. I put out like a, hey, send me some Wolves trade deadline screenshots. I got 133 of the trades that were sent to me, including Julius Randle.
No way.
Yeah, it's...
No
it's,
way.
Well, the reason behind it, Kevin, is because...
The two that weren't were Randle and his wife, right? That's it?
it might have been. There was one that was Nikhil. I don't know if Julius is following me on Twitter, but the thing is there's a real fear that by Randle being here, opting into his $31 million player option for next season, or maybe even signing an extension, is that's going to come at the cost of one of Naz Reid or Nikhil Alexander Walker. And I think in Minnesota, I mean, that fans like both of those guys, but there's a fear that because you've committed to Julius Randle, it is going to cost this team, you know, Naz Reid down the line this summer. Naz was also going to be a free agent once he opts out of his player option. So there's just agita around kind of all things Randle related. But some of that has, I think, overshadowed the fact that Randle has gotten progressively more effective in Finch's system and in the context of this lineup. Though, you got to ask yourself the question of, like, is this the number two guy you want to have with Ant in this next chapter of his entering his prime? Like, it can be better, but still not the right or ideal fit. The problem is, just because you're not sure it's the right fit doesn't mean you necessarily have to trade him right at the deadline. Because, I mean, I don't know, like, what do you think that they're going to be able to get back from Julius if they put it out there?
It's tough to find something that makes any sense at all. A couple of weeks ago on the pod, someone recommended, well, how about Randle and draft picks for Cam Johnson? And it's like, well, yeah, but Brooklyn wants two first-round draft picks for Cam Johnson, and they're in no rush to trade him.
And the Wolves have one first-round pick that they can
exactly
trade.
Exactly. So I don't know what exactly the fit is here. You're not putting Dillingham on the table in a deal like that. So I don't really know what makes sense. Like, what was the best Randle trade you got of the 133 of the 135? Yeah. Was there one that you're like, huh, this kind of makes some sense.
Well, so a lot of them are, well, because Wolves are in the second apron. So it's actually like a really simple activity to put together like Julius Randle trades. It's basically like you can't add another Wolves player into a trade. That's a rule. So it's finding like two players from another team that add up to less than the 33 that Julius is making this season. So it's like Malcolm Brogdon and Jonas Valanciunas. It's Lonzo Ball and Jalen Smith. I'm telling you, man. Like,
Lonzo. Yeah. I like Lonzo.
Yeah, but like...
I know he's got like bad knees, but I like Lonzo.
Pretty big if. Lonzo. Pretty big. I love Lonzo's game too. I mean, there's some, that of that like archetype of trade. That one kind of intrigues me because you could see a world with, you know, Mike Conley aging out here, Dillingham probably not ready to take on a 30-minute role. Like, it might be good to have a 20-minute-a-night Lonzo Ball type of player. But I go back to, man, it's like, all right, you traded Kevin Garnett for Julius Randle for Lonzo Ball. Like, you know, it's just like, that's a pretty... You got DiVincenzo, too. But, like...
Cat, you said KG. You said KG, Kevin
did
Garnett.
I say KG? Cat, that's why I've like, been doing podcasts for, like, 2 hours this morning. But it's... Yes, you go Cat to Randle to Lonzo Ball. You know, that's... Now you're really just shedding salary, you know? Like, I don't like the idea of just a shedding salary deal. If for no other reason, then sure, Julius opts in or you have him on draft night when you have more options to trade. There's more cap space made available. There's the market is cleaner for the Wolves. Like, that makes more sense to me unless they're able to get involved in a Jimmy Butler trade. And is there some sort of way... by maybe like including the Detroit pick, the one first round pick that they have to offer, can you get back like a Jabari Smith in that Houston deal? Can that somehow come to be? Those, if you're going to give up Julius, I want to get something back. And Jabari would be a real thing, you know, also under contract, still on a rookie deal, all that sort of stuff. It's just the trading him for expirings is trading him for expirings, you know, like... It's underwhelming, even if I get the thought process behind it of like, yo, we got to get this $30 million off the books.
It's funny you mentioned Jabari Smith. Like to me, like I look at this Houston roster. I talked about the Rockets a bit earlier with our earlier guest, Danny Green. And we talk about the Rockets, Amen Thompson, and you got Tari Eason, these great defenders, and Jabari Smith has been out. To me, like Jabari Smith is kind of low-key the type of asset the Rockets should be thinking about moving. I don't know if the Wolves deal would make a lot of sense. It all depends on what the context of the deal is. But for Houston, like it could be somebody that they should think about. For the Minnesota Timberwolves, if they do move Randle, to me, it's probably going to be one of those non-obvious types of acquisitions. So like to your point, I don't think it's going to be a Cam Johnson. I don't think it's going to be one of these names that's out there. It's going to be a Brogdon Valanciunas, as you said, Alonzo Ball, somebody that you're not really thinking about with all the names that are really prominently out there right now in the mainstream for trades.
That's what the Nikhil Alexander Walker and Mike Conley for D'Angelo Russell trade was.
Yes.
And that was great. 100%. And that was the same front office. And they kind of, if you remember at that deadline, they were the ones holding up the Russell Westbrook deal with the Lakers. And like, them wanting to, where they dumped that Westbrook to Utah. Is that where that happened there? But the Wolves held out. The Wolves held out and they ended up getting Mike Conley, who did unlock Rudy Gobert. And then they got Nikhil Alexander Walker, who just seemed like a throw-in piece and has now been a huge part of the team for the past couple seasons. And, you know, is free agent this summer, but, you know, could be going forward. Yeah, if they can get a Mike Conley and Nikhil Alexander Walker type deal like they did for D'Lo, they also got 3 seconds in that deal. Then yeah, like jump on it. The Wolves were not in the second apron when 2 years ago when they, you know, made that trade. And it's
big
just
difference.
Big difference, yeah.
Huge limiter to any potential trades. You mentioned Rob Dillingham in passing earlier, how he's not quite ready for a 30-minute per game role, but he's been good. He's been good. You know, he's 9 of 16 on pull up threes this season, 56%, 8 of 19 on catch and shoot threes, 42%. Positive assist to turnover ratio. He's scored 10 plus points in under 20 minutes 3 times this month. So he's playing a little bit more, producing with a little bit more minutes, having some really quality nights. Do you see him as like a 25 minute per game guy at some point by the end of the season? Because Conley's declined. Dillingham's ascending. I just feel like Dillingham, like they traded, Tim Conley traded for Dillingham as a big swing, an upside pick. And this year, I feel like Minnesota, even though he's a rookie and even though he's small and even though he has his flaws, he's still an upside guy. So I'd like to see him get some of those extended minutes by the end of the season. But do you see that happening? Is there any indication that it could happen?
There is not an indication that it could happen. The Wolves are very much given the energy of, like, we are trying to win and maximize this roster, win every single game. There's not the, like, here's 10 extra minutes.
Why can't he be part of that, Dane? Why can't he? Because what am I missing there?
Well, okay, so number one defense in the league last season, right? The Wolves were, and a big reason of that is obviously Rudy Gobert and Jaden McDaniels, but another big part of it was they went, you know, 8-9 guys deep in the rotation, and all 9 could guard, like at a high level. And that was their identity. And that's what I think Finch still believes the identity of this team is and needs to be. And if you look more closely into Rob Dillingham's box score and you go, oh, he played 18 minutes that game versus 6. It's he's playing him in opportunities when it's against, when the opponent has Peyton Pritchard out there. He played 18 minutes against Dallas the other night because Brandon Williams, a 5'11 guy on a two-way, was playing backup point guard for them. Finch is only playing, and I asked Finch about this before the last game, and I'm like, are you looking for opportunistic situations for Rob offensively or defensively? And he said defensively. So that's
great question. That's a really good question.
That's the holdup right now is fears about, you know, the defense and fitting specifically into that identity. You bring up though Conley, and it's kind of like, well, why did you do this trade? You know, why did you go get Rob Dillingham for your 2031 first if you weren't, you know, going to play him on a roster that is young and has an aging Mike Conley? I think the order of operations is like important to think about with this. Draft night was June, whatever, end of June. They don't make the Cat trade until right before camp. Like, they drafted Rob Dillingham in this other vision for the roster. And I remember it was at the facility. We interviewed Tim Conley right afterwards, and he was pumped about getting Dillingham. And he said he's going to play right away. He's going to be in the rotation day one. And that didn't happen. So what happened? Well, you made another really big trade where you brought in Dante DiVincenzo, who he's been the Mike Conley insurance thus far this season. DiVincenzo's out now. So Rob Dillingham is inserted into the rotation in many ways, like by necessity. Like, they need another point guard to be playing. Though, to your point, I think he's acquitted himself well from an offensive standpoint. And he fights defensively. Like, he's not an apathetic defender. He's just tiny.
He's so small and he's so light. Like, he's not just small in height. He's small in weight. Like, he can just get overpowered by even a 185, 190 pound guy.
Where did you have him on your board?
Let's see. I think I had him 10, if I remember correctly.
So what were you thinking like his rookie year was going to look like? Then
it depended on the team. I mean, I thought Dillingham was I never anticipated that Rob Dillingham would go to a team that was just in the Western Conference Finals. Right? Like, I don't think that was even a thought on my mind. Dillingham, I thought, oh, he'll go to a bad team and he'll probably play some extended minutes and he'll be super fun to watch. And, you know, like, you tune into the Wizards or whatever, and like, Dillingham went off for 35 on 25 shots. That's what I anticipated from Rob Dillingham as a rookie. So no, I didn't see this path coming for him at all. It wasn't even a thought on my mind one bit. So when it happened, it was a shocker. Mm-hmm. It really was. But I think with him, I think he's ready. I think Dillingham is ready to score. And as you said in your question to Chris Finch, is it about picking your spots defensively or offensively? That's like a great question to get like an honest answer, because it's true. It's about not exploiting him defensively, because he's nowhere near what he, you know, needs to be defensively. I don't know if he ever will be, though. That's the thing. But I do know Rob Dillingham, regardless of the level, whether it was overtime elite, whether it was high school, whether it was Kentucky, Donda. The dude's just a bucket getter, man.
Don't forget, right? Donda.
Donda. Forgive me, Kanye. Forgive me. I'm sorry. I forgot Donda Academy.
Okay,
to your point, though, even Donda Academy.
Yes.
The dude's a bucket getter. That's who he is. And I think he can help that Wolves offense.
So, again, I think it goes back to the timing of it. Finch wanted that guy, that type of player. He's talked about it for like the couple of years before. Like the Wolves have had, other than Ant, have had no other guard that can like really get in there and, you know, be a bucket. Like, I don't even know if you remember this name. Jalen Noel played like 20 some minutes a game.
From UCLA, right?
Washington. He went to Washington. Yeah, he's a Washington guy. But he played 20 some minutes a night because he like was a guy who could get to the lane, and Finch called it a paint breaker. And the problem was Jalen Noel did not have the overall talent, you know, that Rob Dillingham has. And they went with Shake Milton the season after that. They've been looking for this guard to be able to break the paint, somebody other than Ant. And what happened is Julius Randle is that on this team. So it's become less of a need. That, you know, guard who could get in and spray it out, like Julius Randle plays that role often for them. So there's, I think, less of a need in Finch's mind now than there was, again, on draft night for that archetype of a player on this team.
Yeah. Understandable. I mean, like, to me, like, oh, this whole conversation just makes me want to trade Randle more. Go get Lonzo Ball.
Welcome, man. You just throwing another trade to the 135.
Go get Lonzo. Go get whoever and unleash Rob Dillingham and, you know, see what happens.
I don't know, man. I was on that. There is a growth happening from Randle. And I think the real case is not his style, anything like that. Cause the number, you know, he's got the best EPM on the team. You know that? Better than Ant. Like, he's not having a terrible season. The argument is, if you bring back Nas, then you can only bring back Julius Randle, you can only bring back one of Nas Reed or Nikhil Alexander Walker while staying under the second apron. If Julius is gone, you can bring back Nas Reed at his number, Nikhil Alexander Walker, and you can also use the mid-level exception on another like $10 to $14 million player, depending on where the numbers come in. You're hard capped at the first apron, but like that's the opportunity cost of Julius Randle staying or going. And I get that. I get looking at the salary cap reasons, being like, he's going to cost him elsewhere, but we can't totally dismiss that he's been playing well. And in specific ways, like I brought up before, that five out look, it does help Ant. Cause I mean, when Ant's 25, you think he's going to be playing on a team with a 7'2" guy that's just sitting in the dunker spot? Or do you think he's going to be playing like Shai Gilgeous-Alexander in a five out offense? Like Donovan Mitchell, I guess Donovan Mitchell is a five out offense, but
you
like,
want to make sure he's not playing somewhere else. That's a conversation for a different day, though. Dane, appreciate you joining me in today's episode. Where can we find your stuff?
Dane Moore NBA podcast. Doing pretty much daily episodes on the Wolves. I'm sure we'll have a bunch surrounding the trade deadline, but also just talking about the team on a daily basis. Follow me on Twitter at Dane Moore NBA.
Well, Dane, a lot to watch for with Minnesota these next few weeks with the deadline, and then over the months to come, of course, as they hopefully continue to turn their season around. Thanks for joining me today.
Yes, sir. Donda.
All right, let's bang out some more mailbag questions, starting with something related to the NBA draft from Coach Roach. Coach asked, is Ace Bailey making a case to be the second overall pick in the draft? I'd say yes. That's the short answer. Longer answer is, he already was, even before this recent uptick in his performance overall. His last eight games, 22.6 points, 50% from two. That's an important number to remember. 45% from three and eight boards per game. Now, with Ace Bailey, the knock on him early in the season was he's 6'9". He doesn't get to the basket enough. He's settling for bad shots. Is he really going to be the type of guy that you want to bet on ahead of some of these more reliable guards, Dylan Harper, his teammate, namely being the first name that you hear? However, lately, he is getting to the rim more often. He is driving more aggressively. He's using that frame. And it reminds me of what we saw Brandon Miller do his freshman year at Alabama. Brandon Miller started the year, really wasn't getting to the basket much at all, was not drawing fouls. And then over the course of the season, he got way better at doing that. And now we see with Brandon Miller in the NBA, he's somebody who's able to get to the basket, finishing loudly at the rim a lot of the times. And maybe with Ace Bailey, that's what's happening. Maybe he's figuring those things out there. So he's able to get to the basket more. He's being more aggressive on the boards, been better defensively as well, and he's still shining, doing the thing that he does best, and that's taking jumpers. 41% on pull-up three-pointers. He takes more mid-range right now. 76% of his pull-up jumpers are from mid-range. So he's a mid-range heavy guy right now, but he's showing success pulling up from three. I hope he's able to continue extending his range because that's what he does. He's a bucket getter. But the fact he's able to do more, showing player development, getting to the basket, it makes me feel more optimistic. Those contested mid-rangers could eventually become threes, and he'll always have that mid-range part of his game as well. Question from Mike over on the emails. Mike asked, who has a better chance to repeat, Patrick Mahomes or Mac McClung? This is a good question. It's a really good question. We have Pat Mahomes, who's won back-to-back Super Bowls, and Mac McClung, who has won back-to-back dunk contests. He basically has a residency now for the dunk contest. I'm going to say McClung has a better shot because the level of competition so far is not the type of players that I would expect to win that competition. I mean, Manas Bouzelas, I love him. I interviewed him last year. Really impressive rookie for the Bulls. But Bouzelas, to me, isn't a dunk contest dunker. McClung is. It's a competition made for him. So I'd say Mac McClung has a better shot than Mahomes, who has to go against a great Philadelphia Eagles team. And we saw how tough it was on Sunday for the Chiefs to beat the Bills at home. A lot of mistakes made by that Bills offense in the game. All the discourse on social media about Josh Allen on that final play when Kincaid should have caught the ball. Allen made a hero ball throw, and his tight end should have caught the pass. Ultimately, though, I think Mahomes in a moment like that is Mahomes for a reason. Mahomes probably makes the improvisational play if he's able to. And Mahomes probably also reads the snap prior to that. He's not surprised by the blitz like Josh Allen was. And I feel like that's where those truly elite GOAT quarterbacks, Pat Mahomes, Tom Brady, Peyton Manning, they know that blitz is coming and they have a backup plan in case it actually does. Josh Allen fell short there, and that's why the Chiefs are back with a chance to win a fourth Super Bowl, third in a row, and the Bills are still not able to get there at all. Question from Eric. Are you contractually obliged to keep the beard now that it's part of your promo graphics? I hope not. I mean, there might be a day I shave. Maybe I'll meet somebody and the girl will prefer me clean shaven and I'd be open to shaving. I like my face clean shaven. I like my face with the beard. I'm not against shaving it someday. So I hope Yahoo doesn't force me to keep it. Hopefully we can just change the graphics. I'm not even wearing the glasses right now because the glasses reflect the lights. So, and it looks bad for you guys watching this on YouTube or seeing the social clips. But ultimately, I'm not contractually obliged to keep the beard. Hopefully we can just change the graphic in case I ever do shave it. Question from David. Your Mount Rushmore of guitar players all time. This is easy for me. The two people that really got me into guitar in the first place, Jimi Hendrix and David Gilmour from Pink Floyd. They're legends in my eyes. They are my true goats. The reason why I started playing guitar in the first place, listening to Jimi Hendrix, Machine Gun, live at the Fillmore Reese, David Gilmour, Comfortably Numb, Time. Those are the sounds that really got me into music at a really hardcore level when I was a teenager. The other two are a bit harder. I could say a bunch of names for these. I'll just kind of go with the people I've enjoyed their music the most. Jimmy Page from Led Zeppelin. Jimmy Page, just an innovator, you know, a riff master, great soloist. I'll always love Zeppelin, always love Jimmy Page. And then John Mayer will be my fourth, a more contemporary artist. John Mayer, just, you know, a master of his instrument, as, you know, Jason Timpf and I talked about on the podcast a few weeks back. You know, finger style, you know, just original writing, the guitar soloing. He's versatile. He can play any type of music, Grateful Dead style, blues style. He's played with BB King. He's played with everybody. John Mayer is a true, true legend, and he belongs in my Mount Rushmore there. From Walks Are Fun, how did you balance friends and family while trying to make it in the industry? I think it's just, you know, sometimes you had to say no. Sometimes you have to say no. Like when I was coming up, you know, writing for Celtics blog and freelancing at a bunch of different places, there was plenty of Fridays and Saturdays where I had to say no to going out and say no to, you know, going to watch a game with my friends because I had to write an article after a Celtics game. So I think saying no, but you also do need to continue investing in your friends. And I think that's what I've gotten better at over the years. I moved home
you know, being near friends, being near family. It's nice to be able to hopefully, you know, as the weather gets better, especially to do more stuff with friends out here that I've known for over two decades now. So I think it's important, man. Like, I think there are stretches in my life where I've not invested enough in relationships. And that includes, like, you know, putting time into dating, never mind just hanging out with people that you already know. So I think, you know, people at the end of the day are, you know, what are going to matter most when you're on your deathbed. So finding that balance is important. Sometimes you do get to say no. It's one of the most powerful things you can say, but sometimes you also get to learn how to say yes. You just got to trust your instinct and know what's best. And walks are fun. Nice name. It's true. Walks are course are fun. Anybody that doesn't like walks, that's a major red flag. And last thing you asked, what do you like most about the West Coast and the East Coast? I like this. This is probably a hot take. I prefer the starting times of games on the East Coast and the West Coast, but that's because I'm a night owl. 4 p.m. NBA games really sneak up on you. Your day just goes away. 7 p.m. or 7:30, you're able to get so much stuff done over the course of the day, and then the games start. I like those late starts. It feels bigger when the sun has already set and you're able to watch those games. From Omario, thoughts on Warzone Season 2 for the people who have not already tuned out of the podcast because we've gone off the rails here. Warzone is a Call of Duty game. It's a big battle royale. Over 100 players are on the map. I've played Warzone for years. You've probably heard me talk about it. I've done some streams. Still will be doing some streams this year as well. It's horrible, Mario. It's terrible. It's never been worse. It's an embarrassment for Activision. Truly, it's bad. It's really bad right now. I still have fun playing. I'm still part of the problem. I still play. I still get the new skins. But it's bad. It's bad right now. My real life friends don't like to play as much. My streamer friends don't like to play as much. They need to do something seriously to fix this from so many different perspectives. I think the game has become too complicated with the movement, with the amount of weapons and all the attachments. So that hurts the players who are more casuals. It is a clunky experience when you're actually in it in terms of the movement, in terms of the amount of hackers that there are. It is an absolute joke what a big company like Activision has let this game become. They need, when they bring back Verdansk, the map that everybody may have played in 2020 during the pandemic when Call of Duty Warzone was at its peak, when they bring that back, I hope they really surprise everybody and bring that back, the more simplification of that game from the battle royale aspect and from the weapons and the movement aspect. I think that would go a long way in bringing people back. All right, we have an emailer question here from Andrew H. Andrew asks, what is your best full single rep leg press and what is your best partial single rep leg press? The answer is I don't know. I have not done that. I would love to go to the gym and try some stuff out as I continue, you know, improving my health and fitness this year. But the real reason Andrew H. is asking this question, he doesn't want to be called his real name, is because it's a joke. It's supposed to be from Andrew Huberman, you know, him, the popular health and, you know, tech podcaster. He's talking about the big drama that happened on X over this weekend when Brian Johnson, if you don't know Brian Johnson posted a video of him doing a partial single rep leg press, and Andrew H. made fun of him for it. Brian Johnson is this health guy. He's a billionaire who invests basically all of his time and all of his money into trying to be the healthiest person on the planet. He wants to live forever. The name of his whole shtick is Don't Die. And there's a documentary on Netflix about it, which you gotta watch. It's like a little over an hour long, super easy to consume, that shows his life behind the scenes and what he's all about and what he's trying to accomplish. And it's intriguing. It's intriguing what he does. Like, I know people that do some of the things that he does, like the pill regimen, the workout regimen. I don't know about to the extremes that he does it. I think he takes over like 100 pills a day. It's crazy what he does, super expensive to do. But Brian Johnson's mission is to become the healthiest person on the planet and to live forever. And he posted a video doing a single rep leg press, saying it's like, you know, the 99th percentile of 18-year-olds, even though he's in his 40s or something like that. And people were all on him for it because it looked like it wasn't a full a single rep leg press. And Andrew Huberman commented saying, you know, friends don't let friends do partial single rep leg presses. So that's just a big joke from our emailer, Andrew H., who doesn't want his real name to be used. But check out Don't Die. Very fun Netflix documentary. Let's move on to a question from Roundball Renaissance. What player in the league best personifies Father John Misty's style? This is tough. I thought more about this than I probably should have, because it's a really good question, Roundball Renaissance. With Father John Misty, the main thing that I think about with him is the versatility in sound. Like Father John Misty, the song you hear that's the title track of this podcast is dramatically different than a lot of the other stuff that Father John Misty has released over the years. Every album has its own distinguished style. With that said, Father John Misty's style could also be about just how vibrant of a personality that he is, how powerful of a personality that he is on stage, lyrically. So I've got a tough time here. There's two answers that both of them probably don't work perfectly. One of them is Dirk Nowitzki. Dirk Nowitzki, because there was longevity through different styles of play in the NBA over the years. We saw Dirk dominate on the post. We saw Dirk dominate from three. We saw Dirk dominate with different teams around him over the years. Dirk personality, I would not say, connects with Father John Misty, though. I'd say Russell Westbrook is the name that comes to mind. Just a vibrant, true to himself, doesn't care what anybody thinks of him type of guy, just does his thing regardless. So Dirk and Russell Westbrook are the two answers that come to mind, and they could not be any different as players, but I think combined, they kind of personify who Father John Misty is as an artist and why I love him so much. I mean, pure comedy, way different than Chloe, way different than God's Favorite Customer and Fear Fun, the early stuff. If you do like the title track of this podcast, The Kevin O'Connor Show, the name of the song is I Guess Time Just Makes Fools of Us All. It's off of Father John Misty's new album, Mahashoshana. And the whole album is unbelievable. I think it's his best overall album. I've listened to the hell out of it. It has major replay value. It has some banger songs. It's good to listen to just start to finish. In a day where everything is shuffled, and it's all about singles, to me, this is a true album through and through. Just good to put on song one and let it play out for the next hour. So give it a listen if you like the title track. Thanks to Father John Misty for providing the music to this podcast. Thanks to Emmy and Mike for producing it. Thanks to you for giving us a listen. Please give us a 5-star rating if you're listening on Apple or Spotify. Give a thumbs up on YouTube. That really does help out the show. Please give us one of those. Hope you enjoy the rest of your week. We'll be back again later in the week with Tom Haverstraw. As always, we also got a special guest too. Have a good one.